Hey, welcome to the Create Unknown, the home of Make Something Mean Something. I hope everyone out there caught the first episode of season two of Smiling Friends. If you haven't, check it out. It was absolutely fantastic, as you can imagine. And the outpouring of fan art and mock-ups of Gwimbly has been nonstop entertainment for me in the subsequent days. I am Kevin Lieber, and with me as always is Matthew Tabor.
That is the good news to kick off this episode as a Smiling Friends. Now, from what I understand, the season comes in May. Is that right?
I believe May 12th is when it comes out proper, but they seem to have this this penchant for dropping things out of the blue. And it sounded like, you know, they wanted to hit April Fools as like a fun thing. They did a ton of stuff with the puppets and with all the ancillary content that came out around it, promos, and everything is so, so good. It's so exciting. And it's such a, I was thinking the other day how joyful, I couldn't think of a better word than joyful, everything surrounding Smiling Friends is. It just makes everyone happy, which is ironic because that's what this show's premise is. But at the same time, it makes people happy in a way that virtually nothing else seems to.
I can't recall seeing anybody even disappointed or critical of anything ever. Like on Twitter, people are just overwhelmingly happy with this show. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, it's odd, and it's just a little bit of a miracle, I think, in 2024 that we have this show to rally around and, yeah, for people to make jokes and memes and fan art. And there's been a lot of that this week with Gwimbly, the PS1 character, the forlorn, forgotten PS1 video game character that is the guest star of the first episode. So if you haven't watched it, please, please go check it out. The way that they mix media in Smiling Friends is something that I really love. It's obvious that that's a big sort of selling point for them and something that they're just passionate about is just slapping all different types of animation into the show.
Did you see that that they got the Las Vegas orb sphere ball?
Yes.
Lit up with, was that amazing?
That was amazing. And I was like, what did that cost? Because I don't think it was, I don't think that's cheap to get the sphere to play your, you know, smiley face or whatever it is. So I was really happy about that because it shows that, you know, Adult Swim or Warner, whoever is really behind the show. And that's what we need. We need them to be behind the show, keep it going, promote it, market it, blow it up. You know, we need a lot more official merchandise of Smiling Friends. And I hope that that's something that's coming in our near future.
I can see why it didn't initially, because you don't know how season one of anything is really going to go. But by now, I mean, hey, if they're spending a buck on the orb, and there it is. Conrad just put it in the episode chat, which it looks awesome. Is there anything better? There, like Pac-Man and the Smiling Friends guy are the two best things to ever be on an orb.
Yeah, without a doubt. So yeah, major, major happiness spreading around thanks to Zach and Michael and everyone who worked on Smiling Friends. And yeah, we have a couple more months until the rest of it drops, but until then, definitely go check out what is available right now. So speaking of TV shows, we spent last week discussing the wisdom and the human behavior lessons from shows like Hoarders and My 600-Pound Life, but it wasn't enough. We didn't get into everything. Enough. There was more. There were more layers to this onion to peel back, and I'm interested to hear what those layers are from you.
Yeah, first, though, we've done all this good news, so I want to do bad news.
Uh-oh.
The bad news is that my boss at work has forced me to abuse drugs. I said just a week or two ago what I thought the most dangerous drug in America was, and right now I am supremely high on it. And I don't know, Kevin. I don't want to make you feel bad. I don't want to go into too much detail here, but I've had a bunch of C4 today. And I feel like if I go into detail about that, it'll be like describing, like making out with your ex to you.
I know.
It's just, it's got to hurt on some level. But I wanted to, have a brief little apology because I'm a little hopped up on the C4. I had to record a thing that required a little pep. And the best way to do that is to slam a bit more C4 than I need. And I'm still a little hyper. I'm coming down slowly.
It's really performance enhancing drugs. You know, really, I'm like the Richard Conti of, or what was that guy? The Balco guy.
Victor Conti?
Victor Conti? Yeah. Whoever owned Balco and was supplying steroids to Major League Baseball players and
the clear
Olympic athletes. Yeah. There's a good documentary on that. I think it's,
it was good.
Yeah. Check that out.
It was good. But you're right, though. There's more stuff some of the stuff we talked about before is generally applicable to, you know, to all of us, but not right on the money. Well, there's one element, especially of my 600-pound life, that is extremely, extremely important. And I want to put you on the spot here, Kevin. This is difficult. This is a difficult question. And I mean that. This is not the bad news of C4. This is a real question. If I asked you to describe what trying is, how would you do that?
Oh, that is.
What does it mean to try to do something?
Well, first you have
to. This is not easy.
No, it's not. It's one of those things where I don't want to use the word to define the word. Certainly you have to set out some sort of goal for what you're trying to do. So there has to be some sort of goal at the end to try to achieve. You know, it's obviously a conceptual thing because it doesn't exist yet. Whatever you're trying doesn't exist yet. You haven't accomplished it or else you wouldn't need to try it. So you have to conceptualize, visualize doing something first to know what to try to do. Then you have to figure out how to get there. And then you have to start implementing the steps it takes to get there. And a lot of that is sort of a zigzag process because not everything is going to work out the way that you thought, sort of two steps forward, three steps back, probably along the way. So there's failing involved. And eventually on that zigzag path, you reach some sort, I think, of destination where you can then reflect on whether your try was successful or not.
You've hit all the points that matter. And so when your 600-pound life episode happens, it's going to be like 12 minutes long. They're going to throw it out because it won't be enough material to be 90 minutes. So when you watch this, when you watch these episodes, there's another language element that betrays how somebody is thinking about what they're doing. And it is all of this language around trying. And people will say, Dr. Now will go over what they need to do. And he has a book with a very clear diet plan in it. So you read the book, you know what you should eat and what you can't eat. And then you do that thing and you'll get the results that he expects from you. There's not a lot of complexity to that. But what happens is people say, well, I will try. I will do my best. I will try to do this. And then they come back and they have either lackluster results or bad results. It's not that uncommon for somebody to come back in with a goal of, say, losing 30 pounds in a month, which at their size, they should be able to do on his diet without any trouble, because they're burning many more calories a day than most people are. They'll come back and they've actually gained weight. So he's saying, he always says, well, what happened? What went wrong? And they'll say, well, I tried to do that. And he says, well, you didn't do it. So I thought, what is the mismatch here where these people are saying that they tried? And most of the time, they're saying that they tried and they did their best as an out, as a way to avoid the responsibility of not doing what they needed to do.
An excuse.
Because
right.
It feels like something a little different than an excuse. It's a certain kind of excuse where there's this built-in not having to take responsibility for it because they can always say that they tried. It's like when somebody thinks they've got this sort of mic drop by saying, well, I feel this. And then it's like, well, nobody can ever tell me I'm wrong because that's just my opinion. You know, it's that same sort of, this is built in so that you don't have to actually know anything or be right about it. You don't actually have to follow this because you're saying that you're trying. The people who sort out the difference between trying and what that like philosophical trying and the actual trying, which is a lot closer to the process you described, they're the ones who get there. They're the ones who figure it out. The reason this applies to virtually everything is that when you think about trying to do something, if you're really serious about it, you do what you can do. Okay. Most of the time, you don't have a step-by-step guide the way he provides them with. So let's say it's YouTube videos. You know, you want to try to make a channel. You're going to try at this. You write the most compelling thing you can, the funniest thing, whatever your game is. And then you edit it down to the best of your abilities and throw it on YouTube. Okay. That is the beginning of trying. That's not actually what trying is. The trying part is that then you analyze what happened and do it again, factoring in that knowledge. And so the people on my 600-pound life who say they try, they do their best, and kind of do what they want, they don't make it. They never make it. Not one time does that work. You know, I think of the classic try quote is the Yoda saying, do or do not, there is no try.
I was going to interject with that because as you were going into it, I was like, this is Yoda. This is Yoda.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really interesting because there are different kinds, there are different varieties of trying, and there should be. So like if your next door neighbor's house is burning and you know there's a five-year-old inside, you don't try to run in and save them. You make a decision that you're going to do that or you're not. That's a Yoda try, right? You do the thing or you don't do the thing. That's a different category than the stuff we're talking about. So this category, you do the thing the best you can, and then when you fail, and you probably will or fall short, then you figure out what stopped you. Okay. And this is the really big part, because people on the show will say, and I mentioned this last time, I will do anything for my kids, my husband, my wife, and then live in a way that doesn't lead up to it. So you tried to do that and it didn't work. Well, now you have to ask, what stopped me? What stopped me from doing it? And then attack that issue. So if you say that you're going to do something and then you're not able to do it, the trying comes in when you identify what that sticking point was and figure out why it was a sticking point. This show is a great example of it, because so often that sticking point gets unstuck through some type of therapy. The sticking point is an issue that needs to be worked out that has really nothing to do with food or exercise or lifestyle. They have something that they've got to go over with a therapist. Well, if you're trying, you will hit that wall, realize that there was a wall that kept you from going forward, and then find out how to break down that wall. That's what trying is. And if you think trying is doing what you can and giving it a good shot, that is the most surface level miniature step toward trying that you can possibly do. And it stinks. And all you've really done is given yourself an excuse to say you tried. Now, the other trying is committing to a process where you do that first step, and when it doesn't go as you hoped it would, you stop there, figure out what the problem is, the first one, because there's probably going to be a dozen of them. This is not a two-round process. This is a perpetual process. And then you commit to dealing with that hurdle. And I thought, how few people I know who go about anything like this. The ones who don't generally get nowhere with anything. They're perpetually miserable. They think that all manners of the world have conspired against them, and that's why they're not succeeding. The people I know who try in this constantly breaking it down process, and they're really honest with themselves about what's happening, they all, every one of them, succeeds. It blew me away when I started to think, okay, if this is true, then who do I know who does it this way? Who do I know who does it that way? And there was nobody in the middle. Absolutely nobody. And it's hard. It's really hard. So you have to admit very defeating, difficult things in this process. If you're that parent who will do anything for a kid, and then you continue to eat yourself into a grave, that wall for you is saying, it's important to me for my health and my family's health that I do this. And I was not able to do it. I could not do it. I overate anyway. I couldn't resist the cravings. You know, obviously I'm sticking to the 600-pound life show for this, but you can imagine how many of these, how many situations have their own things here. And if you think about it, how many things you've done where, you know, you've blown it. you've blown it completely. We were talking about bowling stuff before this episode kicked off. If I knew back when I was bowling a lot what I know now about this kind of process, I would have been able to say, I've hit this wall. My results are not what they should be because my physical conditioning is not nearly good enough. I am not nearly strong enough. I'm not, my core is not very strong for what I'm after here. And hey, it's bowling. It's not a raw strength thing, but it's tightly regulated, repeated motion, something like golf. You have to be able to repeat motion like a machine with very little variation. And that requires a fair amount of body control / strength. Now, Conrad says, after bowling, my arms are tired. AF. Yeah, my arms were fine. And so I kind of deluded myself into thinking like, oh, yeah, my arms and legs are, I'm great here. There's no problem. I just need to practice more. I just need to bowl more. No. I hit a wall and it was because I was an out of shape loser. That's it. And it wouldn't have hurt to admit that. I guess I just didn't. It didn't occur to me to diagnose myself in that way. And then what am I going to do about it? Okay, this is the problem. Now, how do I strengthen my core to the degree that I need? And that's what comes up over and over and over with the reality shows that are reality about problems. The interventions, the 600-pound lives, the hoarders, where if the people are honest with themselves that I am doing this thing that I know I shouldn't be doing, and I actually don't even want to do it, I need to figure out what's getting in the way. And then I need to deal with what's getting in the way. Then start the whole process again, and hopefully I go past that and I've solved that issue until I hit the next problem. And you keep doing this over and over and over again, and eventually all those big walls and pitfalls are not in the plan anymore, and you just end up where you need to be. I thought, my God, how many creatives have I known who don't do this? And they delude themselves into thinking that they're trying really hard. They're not trying hard. They're doing what they want to do. I don't know what you've been sipping, but you've got it all wrong. It's time to commit to the Leaf. We've embraced the smoothness and surprising pick-me-up that tea provides. I literally drink it all day long, nearly a gallon a day, and it powers me through research, script writing, and forums on websites that I refuse to name here. But we don't drink normie NPC tea. We drink cultured and refined anime tea from the Dragon's Treasure. Kevin still likes the gunpowder green called Space Cowboy, and I've sampled nearly 40 Dragon's Treasure teas at this point. Lately, I've been slamming black teas like Kentucky Bourbon and liquefied Berserk Despair. Scottish breakfast is deep and peaty, and I smooth it over with Sebastian's Morning Earl Grey, which has the best vanilla cream taste I think I've ever had in a cup. Give me a pot of that with a hot meatball sub from Sal's Pizza and Brooks Barbecue Chicken to wash down my last meal on death row. I highly recommend the sampler packs. You'll want to try everything just like I did. I literally have not had one tea that I wouldn't be happy to reorder. The Dragon's Wings membership fuels new tea experimentation, and the Tea of the Month Club provides a regularly scheduled surprise. And when you order from the Dragon's Treasure using code CREATE, you'll get 10% off your order. That's 10% off using the code CREATE at thedragonstreasure.com. The link's in the description.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, when we were talking about bowling earlier, you know, we had this whole discussion about why you need a bowling coach, which I did not understand, but, you know, you educated me on. It sounds like having a coach, having a doctor now, having a therapist, some sort of third party, impartial third party. I mean, even in intervention, you have that. You have an interventionist, someone who is outside the family to shine a light on, you know, with the 30,000 foot view. Here's what's going on. Let's talk about it in real terms. It sounds like that might be a really integral piece of this because, like, for instance, with your story about, you know, you being an out of shape loser who couldn't break through to the next level on bowling, well, you couldn't identify that about yourself. You know, maybe you have the tools to do that now, but you just didn't then. But maybe somebody else could have if you had some sort of mentor or coach or whomever it was who was at the next level, some sort of Yoda. I mean, let's just go back to Star Wars. That's why Yoda exists. That's why Obi-Wan Kenobi exists. That's why mentor is an integral part of the hero's journey, is that it's that person who's been there, who's wise, who has the experience and the knowledge to impart on the naive, you know, budding hero to say, hey, you are screwing this up and you have to stop doing things this way if you want to get where you're trying to get.
Yeah, well, that's perfectly accurate, that it's all better when you have that outside influence, that outside perspective. And we've talked about this before, how great it is to work with somebody else who can just show you and tell you all the things they're seeing because you don't, for whatever reason. You know, sometimes it's just not even a thing you know exists. So the question is, how do you get that if you don't have it? Now you can get it in a virtual way. You can get it in a weird, like, by proxy sort of way. There are so many videos on YouTube that would have equipped me with that knowledge 15 years ago that I could watch right now. There are these two guys, Brad and Kyle. Brad and Kyle are both excellent professional bowlers. They have a YouTube channel where they do all things bowling. I love these guys. And you can watch their videos and just access this. You can watch any sport you want anywhere on YouTube. Whereas, you know, when I was a kid, it was Saturday afternoons for an hour and a half, a portion of the year. And that was all the bowling I could watch. Well, now you can watch it every hour of the day on YouTube if you want, including live streaming with, I don't know who does the service now, but fully streamed tournaments from beginning to end. You know, you have access to those things. So obviously nobody on camera there is giving you direct feedback, but you're learning these things as you're watching and hearing other people talk. That's an incredible thing. So it used to be you had to come across some kind of Yoda, and hopefully you had one in your family or a neighbor or a teacher that you had access to a Yoda, you bumped into them. You didn't have to go, or if you didn't have that, you had to go on this bizarre Star Warsian journey where essentially a ghost had to tell you about a tiny green goblin on another planet that you had to go and find and then get your wisdom. Okay. Well, now you can just kind of search for it in 5 seconds. And that's an incredible, incredible asset. It's huge.
One thing that I really wanted to mention, I didn't mention this last week, and I unfortunately don't recall the name of the show. I don't know if we've talked about this before. Maybe we have. I came across this, I think, last year, where there was a BBC, I think it was a British show about weight loss. And it was similar to the Biggest Loser type show where, you know, it was following a handful of people on their weight loss journeys. And part of it obviously was calorie restriction. And person after person, they were trying and they were failing. They were not losing the weight. They were, the point is they were adamant.
I know this show.
That they were all following the calorie restricted diet to a T. They were sure that they were only ingesting, you know, 1200 calories a day or whatever the limit was. They were following it and it wasn't working. Well, then what happened is the TV show kind of uncovered by tracking what they were actually eating throughout the day, that they were eating like three times the calories that they thought they were eating. So they were sure, these people, oh yeah, I'm sticking to the diet. I have, you know, my nuts and cheese for breakfast and my light salad for lunch and whatever it was. But meanwhile, they were having all of these snacks and all of these drinks, and there were all of these hidden calories that were just piling up day after day after day, to the point where they were all just completely obliterating their calorie limit. It wasn't even close. It's not like they were limited to 1,200 and they were ingesting 15. It was like they were limited to 12 and they were ingesting like 3,500.
Yeah, the show that you're talking about, I can't remember the name of it because I watched it on the browser. I watched it on my computer. It wasn't on a streaming service where I saw it, so I can't remember the name. But they had cameras everywhere, and then they just played the videos to the people. And when they did this kind of wrap up, it's like, well, here's the number of what you're eating. And they were like, no, that can't be right. I didn't do that. And then they play them the video of all the things that they've eaten. And it's like, this is this many calories, whatever. And there was one where the thing I watched was always a couple, which was cool because then you get two people deviating from it in different ways. But like they went out to a pub one night and drank five or six beers and then came home and like ate a burger. And well, you do the math on that and it's like, all right, you've just tacked on like 1600 calories to your day. And they're like, oh, I guess you're right. But you know, like that's just an occasional thing. It's just that one time. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. It's sort of like saying, you know, my credit card bill has come in the mail and oh, I've maxed it out. But as I go through the list of the things I've spent money on, I'm like, I just bought that one thing. It was just that one time. Well, what do you think happens when all these just that one times add up to a monthly statement? The same thing that happens when all the pub sessions and the snacks and the second portions and all that happen at a monthly weigh-in. You know, it's crazy, but those people all sincerely believed that they were following the regimen and really doing an optimal thing to hit this weight goal that they had. And that show was an eye opener because these were normal people. They weren't teetering on a medical emergency like the people on 600 Pound Life. These were just normal people who, you know, were out of shape, wanted to lose weight. You know, they'd gained a bunch over time. I said, oh, I want to go back to my, you know, the weight I was when I was a little younger. They really believed that it was all going very, very well. I wish I knew what happened after. So they get this caught in 4K moment. They get all the numbers related to it. And I wonder how much it even mattered. I wonder if that changed their behavior at all.
I don't know. I'm sure that probably not for the most part, but not. But it just goes to show how hard what you're suggesting is when you can so like willfully or maybe even subconsciously ignore the damage that you're doing or the ways that you're getting off track of what you're trying to do. It makes it that much harder to do that final analysis and say, hey, where did I slip up? When you think I didn't slip up. How could you even decide which days, you know, oh yeah, it was, you know, Heather at work's birthday, so I had a big piece of ice cream cake. But that doesn't count because it was a birthday.
It was at one time.
Yeah, like everybody, you have cake at the office birthday party, whatever. Okay, and then the next day we went out for drinks because, you know, Sally got a promotion.
Another special occasion.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we just went out for drinks. You know, that wasn't a big deal. And then it's like, okay, well, then also we did have a cheat day the next day. You know, we were really craving pizza. But, you know, it was just that was our cheat day. It's like, like you said, that's not how it works. You can't just always have exceptions to your goal every single day and then be baffled as to how you didn't achieve it at the end.
No, and I have to ask you this before I launch into it. Did I talk about about the cheat days last week? Did I talk about the problem with cheat language and mentality?
No, not at all. I don't recall.
This is probably my final big point on the show. Okay.
Your 600 pound point.
This is my 602 pound point.
Okay.
And I'm gonna make it very personal. I'm gonna ask you some personal questions, Kevin. Do you and your wife have cheat days in your marriage?
No.
You don't every say 2 weeks, you don't have a day where you can just be in a relationship with or have relations with somebody else because it's hard to stick with a marriage every day of your life?
No.
It probably hasn't occurred to either of you to have those cheat days.
No.
Well, that's because you're in a relationship that doesn't need them. That's the difference here. When I talk about cheat days in the food sense, I'm not counting the changes in food consumption that are meant to induce confusion to your body. That's a legitimate thing that people do where they disrupt an eating routine for the sake of optimizing it. Okay. That's different than like, one day every 2 weeks, I'm going to have pizza and donuts because I just really love it. But if I limit it to one day every 2 weeks, that will mitigate the negative effects of it. And it won't be so bad. That'll make it easier to deal with the regimen I am on. If you have to do that, you're on the wrong regimen. If you're in a relationship where you're with people, where your lack of satisfaction or fulfillment means that you're going in a cheating direction, you're probably in the wrong relationship. A healthy relationship with anything, you don't need this. You don't need that periodic time out. You don't. And so when these people talk about cheat days, which are not part of Dr. Now's plan, they just aren't.
Oh, really?
This is something that,
I'm shocked to learn this.
This is just something that people think like, I can just do a little bit of what I shouldn't do. And that's, you know, we'll compromise. That's me trying. No, it's going to work if all the food that you're eating is stuff that you legitimately enjoy. You figured out how to make it in such a way that you like eating it and it fits. It's good for you with whatever your goals are. Then you don't need a cheat day. You don't need a built-in safety valve, a pressure valve, a safety mechanism, because there's no pressure to relieve. And that jumped out at me when you know, it. And this is the excuse when somebody misses, usually badly, a weigh-in goal. Dr. Now is like, well, what went wrong? And well, I mostly stuck to the diet. I tried really hard. I did have a few cheat days. Okay. So you just plain periodically didn't do the thing. And if you were okay with that, it's because the thing itself wasn't palatable enough for you to stick to it. You've made it hard. You've made it hard, or something is making it hard for you to stick to that regimen. And I thought, if you applied this to people, it would sound, I don't want to say twisted, because I know there are all sorts of interpersonal arrangements at this point in time. People have many different kinds of successful relationships, and I don't care about them. If they're happy, then I'm happy. But for most people, if you needed to build in cheat days to your relationship, it would be a very, very bad sign. You are straight up in the wrong relationship. Well, then you'd need to find one that was what you needed. And with food, it's the same thing. What can I eat that I really like, that I enjoy eating, that conforms to whatever I need nutritionally, whether I'm building muscle, whether I'm trying to lose weight, whether I'm trying to maintain, whatever it is. But if you're in a position where you're thinking about a planned deviation, a safety measure, a cheat day, any process where you have that, that process is going wrong. It's going wrong. And this came up with all the burnout talk. Which, did you notice nobody ever talks about burnout anymore? I'm so glad that the YouTube community solved that in like 2021. Because it was just the most pressing issue in the world. Then all of a sudden, nobody talked about burnout.
No, I haven't heard a whole lot about that. I mean, we did a podcast about people retiring because they, you know, achieved their level of success that they wanted and did kind of whatever they wanted on the platform, and now we're doing other projects. That's completely different. What you're talking about of people just, I quit because I'm going to pull my hair out. Unless I'm sure it's still happening in circles that we're not within, but I certainly don't see it to the degree that I remember seeing it 4 years ago or so.
If you're burning out, your process is flawed. If you risk burnout, if you hit a point, and I don't mean to call somebody out here, but I don't think I know them actually. So I saw a tweet where somebody said, you know, I had to take a week off work to manage, you know, stress and burnout. They ended up working. That was the funny part of the tweet, is I spent that week working. And it's like, oh, here's the thing I worked on. But well, yeah, the process shouldn't lead you to that. And this is that trying mentality again, where if you hit a wall that is burnout or cheat day or anything like that, you need to recognize what has happened. This thing, my addiction to this food is so severe that I couldn't bear to go too long without eating it. Or this aspect of my job is so much of a strain that I do it until I can't do it anymore, and then I have to take time off. Well, you figure out how to fix that. You fix that. But yeah, it's a really similar concept in all.
Well, we've gone through that. We've done that with each other when it comes to work. And it's a continual process by having frank discussions about like, what are the things that, you know, make you want to jump off the roof? What are those things? Like, what are those things that you are angry about doing on a Sunday morning? What are those things that you are angry about doing 10 o'clock at night? Mm-hmm. And what can we do so that you don't have to do those things anymore? Because of what you're talking about, which is like, this is the type of thing that is creating the stress that will lead to burnout. Let's identify that and then come up with a solution so that no longer happens. And for us, you know, it's been things that seem really mundane to talk about, but really end up mattering when you have like 9,000 things to do every week. Getting that down to 8,998 can be the difference between the tipping point or not with your stress levels. So like, for example, one of the things that I gave up doing years ago at this point was thumbnails for this podcast.
Oh yeah.
I was doing thumbnails for this podcast for a really, really long time. Every single week, every episode, I would sit down and I would make the thumbnails, which is not a labor intensive task. It takes half an hour, you know, at most, typically, to put together a thumbnail in Photoshop. So on paper, you would say, what is your problem? Doing this for a half an hour every week really is ruinous to your productivity and your stress levels? And the answer was, yeah, it is. I have to stop doing this task every week. And there have been a series of those over the years where it's almost similar to the concept of like, well, it's just a cheat day. This doesn't really matter. Who cares that I had the birthday cake at the office today? It's just a little thing. It's a little piece of cake. Well, you can find those little pieces of cake in your work. I certainly have, that on paper seem like no big deal, but they add up into causing problems.
Yes.
And that's why it's hard. I think it's one of the reasons certainly why it's hard to do this, because it might be something as simple as, Kevin, stop making the thumbnails for the podcast and your life will improve, which seems ridiculous, but it's true. And there might be a dozen of those things for everyone.
Yeah.
It's just really hard to gauge sometimes, I think, how impactful small things are on people.
Yes. Yeah. And you going into detail about that made me realize two things. And one is that this is all really a question of dealing with failure. And I mean failure in the technical sense. I don't mean it in the judgmental sense. Like, oh, you stink at this and you failed. I stink at everything. I fail with everything until I don't. That's the process. But think about failure with a car. It just breaks down on the side of the road. Something has caused this car to fail. Maybe it needs a part replaced. maybe you did something to overheat it. You've been towing too much, and it shuts down. Well, what's the intervention? You fix the part. You could be that. Maybe you get rid of the car. Maybe it's not the right car for you and you junk it. There are all sorts of ways to deal with it, but you would know exactly how to respond if it was a car. You'd figure out what you could afford, what you wanted to do, how it fit into your life. Maybe it is time to get another car. I don't know. But you would think about all of these things to figure out, what am I going to do with my car so that I have a car that I can drive? And it wouldn't upset you. It wouldn't hit you on an emotional level. It stinks to deal with a car problem. That would bother you. But you wouldn't take it personally. Just be like, well, this is what's happening with my car. It failed and now I need it to go. I need it to not fail. There's that same dispassionate element where you have to think about your life and the activities you're doing kind of like that car, where if it's not working how you want it to work, then what's stopping that from working? But the thing that I realized as you were talking is how good people are at this. They're actually great at. Do you know who the best people in the world are at doing exactly this?
Auto mechanics?
They're, well, yes, I suppose. They're your people, Kevin.
My people?
Because this is exactly how you play a video game. This is exactly how you play a video game. You do what you can do until you reach the spot where you fail the mission, you fall in the lava, whatever it is, you die. And you start back at the beginning. And when you hit that point again, you know that you've got to dodge a split second sooner. You've got to duck here, or you've got to use this weapon and not that weapon. And you make that adjustment and you go a little further in the game. And then you're going to hit another one. And this is the point of a video game. This is how you play almost every video game. And people beat video games. And the whole time you're trying to beat the game and to advance as far as you can in it. And people are great at this. They don't get the same results. Some gamers are better than others, but they're all doing the same process. And they know that's the process to reach whatever their goal is. And they do have different goals. You know, when I played World of Warcraft, I've talked to many kudos about this in the past. I really loved that game. I didn't want to do big raids. You know, I didn't want to do 40-man raids. The raiding content was not where I wanted to go with the game. But I did the same process with other elements, first reaching the level cap. And then I did like PvP. I liked arena matches as well. So you upgrade the gear slowly to get a little better in PvP, you know, and you get the technique and study your class and the classes you go up against. You refine things slowly. But the whole time I'm getting smoked in matches. Now it's a ranked system, and so you get a numerical value on how good you are, how bad you are. And that was just the process, though. I was having this constant failure and adjustment. And pretty much every video game is that. So why are people, this is my question for you, Kevin, why are people so comfortable with it, so good with it? And it's a recreational thing that they put a significant part of their life into playing with, and then they don't do it at all in their normal life. How does this phenomenon exist?
I mean, that is a question for some very smart psychiatrist, probably.
Because, isn't that strange, though?
It is strange. I mean, obviously, one of the biggest problems I think we've already identified is just people have blind spots to themselves. You know, it's harder. It's much easier to say, okay, this boss is weak to ice, and I have an ice weapon. That is way easier to identify, to analyze that situation and come up with a solution than it is to say, why can't I find food within the range of 1500 calories a day that I can prepare regularly? I enjoy eating. I can buy regularly. Like, that is way harder than a video game.
Here's my follow-up question. For the first time, you go into a boss encounter and you have a fire weapon and you get destroyed. It's instant game over. You stink. You find out one way or another that you need the ice weapon. You love this process and you love the feeling of going back with the ice weapon and beating the boss. It's a fist pump. It's That's the reason you play the games. If you saute some chicken and it's bland and it stinks and you don't like it, why don't you feel that same challenge and attitude where it's like, okay, now I need to figure out how to make this chicken taste good because I'm going to feel great about it when I finally do. I've beaten that chicken boss.
I don't know.
Why does that not happen?
I don't know why that doesn't happen. But
I can't figure it out.
It doesn't seem to. No.
Isn't it weird?
Well, though? I mean, it is weird because I was going to say that you don't get, you know, a trophy doesn't pop up on the screen that suggests that you finally won or whatever. You don't get the new loot for beating the boss. All you get is a tastier chicken. But like, who doesn't want a tastier chicken? That seems like that is the reward. But instead, you would just make something else that you know you already like, right? And say, well, I'll just eat this Hot Pocket instead, because it takes 2 minutes and it's delicious.
Maybe that is the issue here, is that the alternative that's awesome is easy and right there. Whereas there's not really that same alternative in something like gaming.
You would have to have no other option but to make the chicken taste good. If you had no other option, if you were on a desert island with only chicken and various spices and herbs, okay, you probably get to that goal. You eventually figure out how to make the tastiest chicken because it's your only option. If you are at Walmart and you could buy anything to eat, then you just ignore the chicken you don't know how to make well and you get the Hot Pockets. Whereas in a video game, you can't just avoid that boss. You want to progress in the game. Can't just go around it. Can't just beat the Hot Pocket boss.
How do you fix this? How do you address that? Can that be addressed when it's so the difference that I'm hearing is that it is so easy to fail with something like food or like a YouTube channel where, yeah, why would I go through all this bullshit when I can sit and just watch really good YouTube or Netflix or Hulu or just consume all of this entertainment? Why would I go through the insane grind of making the thing when the alternative is I just like click a button and have a ball? That feels really similar to me.
That's probably its own podcast, because I've been thinking about that as I've been going through these old popular science magazines. The amount of knowledge, hard work, and intellect that went into a single issue of popular science magazine is absolutely staggering. Whether it's like analyzing how a new projection TV works, explaining how these brand new LCD portable computer screens work and how that is different from cathode ray tube screens. Mm-hmm. Dude, the level of detail in this magazine that was just a normie magazine for people to, you know, read at the dentist office is bonkers. And now, who is doing that? No one is doing that. Not recreationally, for sure. Because why would you do that? Here's a better example, okay? Here's a perfect concrete example. Many, many, many decades of popular science had articles dedicated to building your own furniture, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, here's how to build a bookshelf that swivels and it can, you know, turn it into like a door that's to your secret library or whatever. You know, here's how to build this type of bed that has drawers in it. Wow. Wouldn't that be so amazing if you had a bed with storage? Well, here's the lumber that you need to buy and here are the dimensions of the cuts, you know, everything. Whole plans of like how to build this. Okay. That's gone. Cause you could just buy all that crap now. You could just buy it. I can just buy a bookshelf on hinges that I can install tomorrow. I can have it shipped to me for free from Home Depot and have it in 2 days.
Yep. And you can get an IKEA style thing that holds up really well, that's very reasonably priced, that looks good, that you can put together pretty easily with stick figure instructions that have no words.
You need no knowledge of anything in order to construct like a beautiful, functional, like exact style that you want to match your living room, whether it's like a shelf to hold your record collection or a new, you want to put a bar in your basement, like all of that stuff you can just get. So this is the same thing. It's like,
it is.
The alternative is way more convenient, a lot more fun, a lot easier. So why would you go through spending how much time would it, you'd have to, in order to like build a bookshelf door, I would need to buy a whole bunch of equipment. I'd have to like convert my garage into a mini wood shop. I need to get all the lumber. I would need to learn how to safely make all of these cuts because I don't know what I'm doing. Right. And then
it's a $600 chicken sandwich.
It's the $600 chicken sandwich. Yeah. When you could just go to Popeyes and get a way more delicious chicken sandwich for $6. That's why this is hard.
Is this pushing us into a discussion that like you need to have these hard things, that it's actually better for things to be worse? Because this gets really tricky to me, and I don't know the answer here.
Because I think we both disagree with that and agree with that at the same time. So
yeah, I do. Yeah.
Because you need things to be harder. You do need rails. You do need guidelines. You need bounds and boxes. It's like that with, I mean, I'll just give the example of the bound and box that we're within right now with popular science, because that's a box. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a box that we're not in on Vsauce 2.
Right.
We have, there is a box on Vsauce 2, but it's a different box. The box on popular science is a specific box because it is a 150-year-old brand that millions and millions of people are familiar with. They have a lot of fond memories of, and they have emotions and attachments to what is and what was and what should be popular science. Now, I bring that up because I have personally found a lot of freedom in coming up with ideas for videos by being in a smaller box. It's easier to be in a small box to come up with ideas because you know where the walls are, you know where the ceiling is. And when you're bouncing the ball around that box, it comes back to you much quicker.
Yeah. It has been a much easier process in that sense, where we have a great deal more work to do and more videos coming out, a crazier schedule. That's all much, much, much more demanding. But figuring out what that content is has been much smoother. And I think you're right that it's because of those bounds. It's because of those rules.
Yeah, because you know where you are. If you don't know where you are, then you have to make that up. And that's so much harder than saying, okay, here's where I am. And what can I do in this playground? I'm at this playground, and it has monkey bars, and it has a jungle gym, and it has swings. Do I want to go on the swings, or do I want to go in the monkey bars? You know, rather than being at Disney World, and you're like, well, I don't even know where to begin. Do I go to the Animal Kingdom? Do I go to Epcot? Do I go to the Magic Kingdom? Do I go on this ride? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is awesome. Like, Disney World rules. It's way cooler than a playground, but man, is it a lot? It's the paradox of choice, right? Which is the thing with the jelly beans, where if you present someone with three jelly beans, say like grape, pineapple, and cherry, you say, which one of these three jelly beans do you want? They choose one, and then you ask them if they were satisfied with their choice. They invariably say yes. If you present them with 64 different flavors of jelly beans, there's lime, there's popcorn, there's chocolate, there's peanut butter. No matter what they choose, when you ask them, are you happy with their choice? They're unsure because there were so many other things they could have chosen that could have been better.
This reminds me again of gaming, because I had a massive break between NES and modern things, which, by the way, did I tell you that I gamed months ago?
No.
I played Stray for like an hour or two.
Oh, I thought you would love that game.
I really liked it. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't picked it back up, but I really enjoyed the time that I played. It was the night. It was a nice blend of like accessible puzzle solving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I wasn't lost.
And you're
but
a cat.
I had a really, yeah, it was incredible. But I had this big gap in gaming where I went from NES to, you know, computer stuff. I had a gap in console gaming, right? And I played like Age of Empires 2. I love that. I love those games. But, you know, this isn't a console game, but like by the time I got into like proper modern gaming again, it was that World of Warcraft style. And well, that's an open world game. And so it's like you learn on these left to right platformers that are incredibly linear and 2D and have a really basic set of rules. You can jump, you can run fast, you can duck. And like, that's the extent of life. And then all of a sudden you play through a tutorial and like, wow, this is really cool. The graphics are amazing and I can move in every direction. And when that tutorial is done, it's like, here's your sword. Now go enjoy the World of Warcraft. And it was not quite overwhelming, but it was paralyzing. It was like running around aimlessly for a long time before I figured out what I even had fun with. It was a totally different process going from regiment or like rigid platformer to open world, whatever the hell you want. In the end, that became amazing because I love doing stuff like farming and playing the auction house in Warcraft. Which is, these are like sidebars to the game, the end game economy and stuff. Like, that's not the actual game. But I was able to do it and enjoy it as much as the people doing, you know, heavy raiding. But yeah, it was definitely paralyzing and overwhelming at first until I learned to love the process of open world, you know. And I think all of this stuff really applies strongly. And with going back to the food thing, there's almost nothing that's more open world in reality than food.
Yeah.
Especially now with the Uber Eats and DoorDashes bringing you anything you can think of and pay for.
Yes.
Oh, it's the ultimate open world, isn't it?
Yeah. All of the choices are a touchscreen button press away. Right? To the point where people on Twitter are arguing over whether or not, you know, microwaving TV dinners is too hard.
Yeah.
It's that level.
Yeah. I don't know what to do here. I don't, because, you know, it's like any of those foundational concepts like liberty and freedom being the best thing in humanity. The more liberty and freedom you have to do whatever you want to do, the better. And then that's also kind of the most dangerous, difficult, worst thing that can happen is that freedom.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I've mentioned probably too many times about that moment in the grocery store with the cheese with a girl in Eastern Europe. I mentioned this to you, right?
Yeah. She didn't like having so many options for cheese.
That's right. And that's this issue. Standing in front of the refrigerated section where she hates all the choice. I love all the choice. She's much more comfortable when she's in that little rigid box of, yes, I will take the brown paper wrapped thing marked cheese and be on my way.
Right.
You know, so where is the balance in that? And you can certainly fail harder. You can fail harder in the open world systems.
Right. Yeah. Well, ultimately, I think it's good to recognize what the process of trying is. I'm glad that you laid that out. I thought that was really useful. I hope that people found use in listening to that. And also this process of like real rumination, I guess you would call it, that needs to occur as part of that staggered journey of trying, where you are being self-reflective and trying. And if you can't do that to yourself because you're blind to it, where it's like you can't smell yourself sort of thing. Yeah. And you need somebody else to say, hey, buddy, you kind of smell like hot dogs. And you're like, really? And maybe you need a hot dog nose buddy in your life and you need to reach out to. It might be worth considering.
I want to say one line before we go, though. Do not say that you're trying if you're not doing the process that Kevin laid out and that I added to. Don't tell yourself that you're trying to do something if you're not doing that, identifying the failures and the things that are stopping you, trying to solve them, and then starting the level again and hoping to get past that point. Don't tell anybody you're trying if you're not doing that. If you are doing it, then yes, you are absolutely trying and it's probably going to work. But if you're not, then don't lie to yourself and don't lie to anybody else because you are not trying.
All right. On that note, thanks everyone for joining with us. Boss Threads, Conrad, Rudo, Starro, Bad Spoon, Vibecat, a bunch of people here in the Discord chat. If you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/thecreateunknown. We are a Patreon supported podcast. Until next week, we will see you, Space Cowboys.
Thanks for listening to The Create Unknown. We make this show with the support of our patrons. 100% of that goes directly to keeping episodes going every week, and the recent support has been amazing. Sidpoke, NRM, Venture Addicts, Weezer Good, you all really do make this show happen. Thank you to the Tots and Dumpster crew, old and new, who save tiny little lives every month. Thank you to our grizzled, battle-hardened child infantry. Clemente De Los Santos, Dan the Latch, Demetrius Andrews, Erica, Farrakhan, Jen Mefasanti, Kevin Menard, Mikhail Steinke, Monahim, Natsu, Penny Peddler, Risebread, Ryan Kinder, Samuel Manser, Sean S., Sean Malone, and Tom Vidioger. And a tremendous shout out to our elite baby gang commanders. Atrocious Guff, Cat, Dojangles, Graham Robertson, James Gallagher, Jeff Davis, Orange Vanilla Coke, Patrick Pister, TCU's personal pilot, Andy, Ryan Carroll, Baseweight, Vintos, Yetis Deletus, Jonas Walter, Nathan Robinson, Jelxies, and of course, Trevstead. You are the elite. Thank you as well to our indentured servants, producer-editor Ben Webster, Minecraft mogul Laterman, Discord kitten wrangler Conrad, and producer emeritus Dan Joshua. Thanks to Baseweight for use of Created in the Unknown for the opening theme. Thanks to Electro Voice for giving us mics to sound good on top of it. And a special thanks to Main Gear for powering all of our PC endeavors. The Create Unknown is an Unknown Media production in partnership with Studio 71.